ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This will had come about in the most suspicious circumstances you could possibly imagine.
Who gets what when someone dies, and who decides?
The difficulty with undue influence often is proving it.
Join me, Damien Carrick, for the Law Report special series on wills, Over My Dead Body.
The person felt like they had no option. It's difficult to prove that.
To hear, search for The Law Report and look out for Over My Dead Body. Find it on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. The cliche of heading off into retirement goes something like this. A farewell morning tea at the place you've worked for years, your team giving you a novelty-sized card and well wishes, and then you commuting the half hour or so home from work for the last time. But what if your work has had no fixed address? If it's meant you've travelled the country or the world, where do you even decide to stop wandering and put down roots? Research into the retired lives of roadies is coming up, and if you've had an itinerant career, I'd love to know what that's looked like for you. Also ahead, if someone was bad-mouthing your best friend, you'd go into bat for them. But what if the person they're down on is themselves? That's soon here on ABC Radio National. But first, in the past week, there's been a horrendous stream of news about alleged sexual assaults and violence against women. The details of these stories are harrowing. Several cases allegedly involve teenage boys. And these stories have come just days after new research from the University of Melbourne was released, finding that young people are now significantly more likely than older generations to hold hostile attitudes towards women. We know it's a problem. We've talked about it here before many times. It's easy to feel like nothing has changed. But today my guests want you to know that there is hope and that it's conversations like these and the ones they prompt with the young people in our lives that can make a difference. So for young men, where are the opportunities to intercept ideas around misogyny and violence and offer an alternative? Because it can take a lot of courage to change your mind about something, but it is possible. And I wonder if you can relate to this. Is there a belief you held when you were younger that at some point you shifted your perspective on? I'd love to know what changed your mind. What have you changed your mind about? And here with me is Dr. Sarah Meagher, Senior Lecturer at the University of Melbourne. She's led the research project into misogyny and youth radicalisation in Australia. Sarah, welcome to Life Matters.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you've been looking into this. What did you find sort of top line?
So our top line finding was that the most stable predictor of extremist attitudes in Australia was the holding of misogynistic attitudes and attitudes that excuse violence against women. The key element of this research was trying to explain the relationship between gender attitudes and extremist attitudes. And so we were really interested in how these attitudes about women can formulate into more extreme types of violent attitudes.
So this is attitudes in both men and women?
Yes, that's right.
And what was the sort of age profile?
We were looking at youth as a particular demographic of interest because the Australian government has identified young people between the ages of 10 and 24 as overrepresented in countering violent extremism programs. But we also sampled a national sample of adults to compare with the youth so we could see whether there is a higher concentration in 13 to 17-year-olds or the adult population.
And you found that there was this higher level of these misogynistic attitudes in younger people than in older people, which kind of goes against maybe the sort of popular view that people get more conservative as they get older?
Yeah, that was actually quite surprising to me, especially on the gender attitudes scales that we used, that our teenage respondents, both male and female, were more likely than boomers, for example, quite a bit more likely than boomers to express agreement with a range of quite hostile, sexist and misogynistic attitudes.
Do you mind, like, I don't want to give too much oxygen to things, but can you sort of paint me a bit of a picture?
So we had questions from validated psychological surveys, like the misogyny scale that says things like women exploit men for their own agendas, it's safer not to trust women too much, women will lie just to get ahead, things like this to measure a degree of mistrust and I guess hatred of women. And then we also included a range of violence against women measures. A lot of them came from the ANROWS National Survey. And they include things like sometimes a woman will make a man so angry he can't help but hit her, or a male partner is entitled to use physical force if the female partner argues with him or refuses to obey. And worryingly, our Gen Z respondents were on these like traditional violence attitudes up to four times more likely than boomer men to agree with these attitudes.
If it's not coming, if they're not learning these ideas from the older generation, where are they coming from, Sarah?
Well, our research did find that there was a strong relationship between what people are exposed to online and these misogynistic attitudes. So we included a lot of questions around types of engagement people do online, social media, forums, live streaming, gaming, etc. And also asked them about like time spent. And time spent wasn't the big factor, but the content of what people were engaging with seemed to have quite a bit of influence on their attitudes towards women. And the key ones that we found were actually a bit surprising. We anticipated that maybe social media, online forums, online gaming would have a significant influence. But the three main ones were manfluencer or manosphere content, online dating, and online pornography.
Interesting. Well, two other people who've been grappling with how to counter these sorts of influences face-to-face are with me. They're both called Daniel. Daniel Principe is a youth advocate and educator and a board member for the Domestic Abuse Resource and Training Institute, the DART Institute. And Daniel Allars, Dan, for today's purposes, is the New South Wales State Manager from the Top Blokes Foundation, which runs mentoring programs for young men around the country. Daniel, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
I might start with you, Dan Allars. Do these findings from Sarah's research surprise you?
Surprise, I'd say no. Certainly as Sarah said, the sort of content that we're seeing and like the messages that are getting promoted, like that's pretty consistent with that. It's disappointing, I think, is what, you know, to say is that, you know, the young men feel that that's what they have to say and that's what they should believe, you know, to be a man in this world.
Have you seen a shift in the kinds of conversations you're having since the rise of these sort of manfluencers, I think the word is that Sarah used?
Yeah, a little bit. So, you know, I've been running with Top Blokes since 2018 and sort of the shift in the conversation, you know, post-COVID with young men, particularly what really stuck out to me there was, you know, the women exploiting men to get ahead, you know, that narrative, which is really easily challenged, but we are certainly seeing that come through. But I think it's, you know, it's really young men, from my point of view, I see a lot of parroting of that sort of messaging.
What about you, Daniel Principe? How does this chime with what you're seeing on the ground?
Yeah, sadly not unsurprising when so many boys every single day, and here in southeast Queensland the last couple of days, you know, year 6, 7, 8 boys telling me that, yeah, they see content online that says women should go in the kitchen, make a bloke a sandwich, that women are gold diggers out to fleece men for their money. And you're kind of like, do 11-year-olds really need to be warned about this? Does anybody? Like, and the increased suspicion / hostility to women that all young boys seem to be bombarded with. Because when I ask them, are you hearing this? They all put their hands up. And of course, as Dr. Maher's research highlighted, the role of pornography as well in inflaming these challenges.
Yeah, tell me about, like, you've been literally out with running workshops in the last day or two. What have been coming up in these sessions?
Yeah, so hearing from boys themselves who are being presented with information about women that so frames them as this other, this enemy, this person that's out to get you. And then, of course, I playfully say to them, boys, like, are you talking to women and girls in real life, right? You know, and when I say that to the college students, they jokingly say back, no, we're too scared. And there's some truth in that. Do you know what I mean? And if your whole worldview, your frame about the opposite sex, especially if you're looking to have a romantic relationship with them, has been shaped by these vindictive men online who are weaponizing kind of grievance attitudes, victimization that the world is against these boys, it's just awful. It's so awful to think that that is reaching them before they've got to form their own attitudes, values, and hopefully positive experiences with people around them, irrespective of gender. So we have to get in younger and younger. That's certainly been my experience, and thanks, Dan, for sharing yours as well. Like, I feel like I have to start with that critical thinking, that building compassion and empathy and not seeing people as an other that's against you at younger and younger ages.
When you're talking to those very young guys, are you worried that maybe if they haven't come across it, you're almost putting ideas in their head?
Sadly, no, because most of them have already seen this content. And I want to be clear, that doesn't mean they all agree with it, doesn't mean they like it. But if I walk into any class of year six boys and upwards and say, are you seeing these sorts of messages? 90%+ are putting their hands up. And then it's about us actually helping them think through it. So the boys are really aware of what's in the media cycle right now and the allegations and the awful behavior of men towards women. And they're already asking questions about that. And Dan used language that I'm sympathetic to. They're already starting to parrot some of the rationalizations that frame women as the problem in all of this.
Well, you're listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm with Daniel Principe, a youth advocate and educator, Daniel Allars from the Top Blokes Foundation, and Dr. Sarah Meagher from the University of Melbourne. We're talking about what it takes to change people's minds in light of Sarah's recent research, which found young people are now significantly more likely than older generations to hold hostile attitudes towards women. And I wonder if you've had a belief that you held when you were younger, at some point you shifted your perspective on it. If there was something that changed your mind, I'd love to know about it. Dan Allars, I wonder if you've found particular moments that people are more open to examining their own ideas.
Yeah, I think when we create a safety for young people to be able to come together and explore their ideas where they feel like, you know, they're not necessarily being, you know, talked to, they're being spoken with, you know, and that takes time, you know, for our mentors coming into a room. They need that sort of, you know, week on week on week, building trust to be able to, you know, a young man can throw out an idea and then not feel like they're being torn down for it. They're being asked, you know, why do you feel like that? Where's that idea come from? It then creates safety. So, you know, with a lot of us, we're just too scared to be able to voice our feelings, both good or bad. So, you know, when we create a space for that and boys really, really, and I think as we, you know, you said at the beginning, we want to look for a bit of hope here. I think boys and young men are really keen to have this conversation and these discussions, but they just need the safety to be able to do it.
Daniel Principe, when you do counter some of these negative ideas, what kind of reaction do you get from the guys?
They're honestly asking quite a lot. Like, they're not actually rage baiting. They love talking about rage bait. They're genuinely asking a question. So I've recently been asked by a boy, you know, how do you control your wife?
Okay.
You know, right? And the other boys all went, oh, like they knew that that was an interesting question. And I obviously just answer it, right? We talk about it and it gives me a free hit to talk about hopefully what I think is a really healthy dynamic and what respect looks like and autonomy and, you know, having this mutual desire to seek out the good of the other, all this sort of stuff. And so that comes up. Like yesterday, you know, women apparently are doing this for attention, you know, putting in these, allegations of sexual assault, men offending against them, that's for attention. And then we unpack that because I said, well, what attention are these young women getting? We don't know their names. It's not like it's helped build their social media profile. In actual fact, they're receiving a backlash and would receive a backlash if they came publicly. Like people would go after them willingly to tear them down, right? I don't see much to gain, but they've already heard that. But I'd rather them ask the question in the classroom so that we can talk through it and then finish it by saying to the boys like yesterday, hey, how do we want to show up for the women and girls around us right now? What would it look like to show up well, given how scary and unsafe these realities are and how we speaking about it could affect somebody?
You said the word rage bait before, and sometimes I do wonder whether it's kind of like trolling. Like you sort of chuck stuff out there, you don't really think it, you're sort of trying to get a rise out of people. And if someone had asked me that question, Daniel, it would work. Yep. They're like, how do you control your, how do you prepare for conversations like that so that you can actually respond in a way that's useful?
Yeah, I think for me, I've had enough time in the saddle to just practice like not reacting, being curious, trying to understand as best as possible the heart behind a question. And whether it is rage bait or it's not, I'm always assuming like this gives me an opportunity to speak even to everybody else who might be listening in the room. Right. And that is what I frame this as, like, okay, this gives me an opportunity to speak into this and hopefully illuminate some of the misinformation and the kind of manosphere talking points that pop up.
Well, Sarah, your report included recommendations. What kind of things do you think we need?
Yeah, I think in line with the Daniels, what they've been suggesting, we do need earlier intervention and a better messaging towards young boys that enable them to develop the critical thinking before this content meets their eyes. And so some of the recommendations I make are, you know, national mandating of respectful relationships education in early years, and also regulating the content that people are exposed to, because we can prepare them before, you know, they're accessing social media at 16, let's say, but the data also shows that this content is influencing adult men as well. And if we recognize that as a social harm that we feel, you know, as a nation, we're better off without, then I think this should give us the impetus to look at ways of preventing that content from being algorithmically amplified and just pumped out to so many eyes based on the gender of the audience.
So some of it is regulatory, some of it is programs. Dan Allers, what about the role for parents, teachers, people, just random people in a boy's life?
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously the online space plays a big part in how we, you know, get information, but, you know, we shouldn't give them too much credit, or we shouldn't really give them too much power, because the influence that, you know, parents, teachers, coaches, mentors have in a young person's life is huge. And so, you know, we need to be the ones having the conversation with young men about what a healthy relationship looks like. What does healthy masculinity look like? You know, let's not leave the internet to educate our young people. You know, we should be doing that. And I think Daniel gave a great example before of, you know, even, you know, our programs are structured and they are, you know, a lot of evidence-based stuff, but how we interact and how we challenge ideas is probably just as important. And that mentoring, that side of, you know, how do we have conversations? How do we challenge different points of view? That is what young people are really going to take away from our interactions. So, you know, constant little conversations with our young people is going to do far more good than just allowing the internet to educate our children.
Sarah, is there any sense that the social media ban for under 16s has helped stem this flow of online content?
We don't have data yet to be able to say definitively, but the teacher respondents to a survey I did, a national survey of Australian teachers, was overwhelmingly supportive of the social media ban and indicated that they felt like it would make a difference, even though we don't yet have the data to say.
It can be a really exhausting conversation to have over and over again. Daniel, do you have hope that we can make headway here?
Absolutely. I really do. I don't want to play down how ugly some of these attitudes are and that it has real world impacts. Especially my hearts are always with the female teachers across our nation who have been on the front line copying this and having to navigate this so disproportionately and unfairly. And I ask boys, you know, are female teachers respected as much as male teachers? And they say no. Like, they don't even hesitate. So they know that. So that exists. And at the same time, everywhere I go in every postcode in all sorts of schools, there is a growing number of boys who I think are light years ahead of where my mates and I were once upon a time in terms of their empathy, their insights, their critical literacy skills, right? Their ability to articulate a healthy relationship. Now, do they have the skills to create one just yet? Maybe not, but neither did I, right? So that's what gives me hope, is seeing these boys wanting more and how they engage with this content. content and how they themselves, I think, demonstrate so much that makes for a good human in ways that I think they're doing a better job. And sadly and uncomfortably, those two truths sit side by side in my work.
Dan, Alice, how about you?
Yeah, I think I agree completely with what Daniel says. I think what we see is, you know, a lot of times you can walk into a room or a program for the first time and, you know, we've just started working with businesses and, you know, even my own prejudice thinking, oh, like, you know, are young men going to want to have these conversations? And, you know, every time they do, they're very, very keen to be part of the solution. They want to be called forward to be part of the solution because they know what's going on is not okay. They just need the language, the confidence to be able to call it out and need to be, you know that other men feel the same way and we need to show them that. So I see a lot of hope with how they engage when they're given the opportunity. And, you know, if we can bring more young men particularly to this conversation and more young people in general to this conversation, you know, there's a lot of hope there.
Well, Daniel, Sarah, thank you all so much for chatting with me today. Daniel Allers is the New South Wales State Manager at Top Blokes Foundation, which runs mentoring programs for boys and young men around Australia. Daniel Principe is a youth advocate and educator, board member for the DART Institute and an ambassador for the Women's Resilience Centre and the National Consent Can't Wait campaign. And Dr. Sarah Meagher, senior lecturer at the University of Melbourne. She's led this research project into misogyny and youth radicalisation in Australia. And yeah, some of the statements that we were talking about today might have raised some concerns. There's help available or 1-800-RESPECT, 1-800-737-732, Lifeline 13 11 14. David has texted in saying, on misogyny, I was converted into a fundamentalist church at age 25. We were taught that women were second order pinnacle of creation, so they could not teach or preach. Thankfully, I married a wonderful woman, so much more intelligent and with much higher qualities than myself. And I realised what a load of garbage this church teaching is. Unfortunately, there is still an organisation very active on university campuses promoting this horrible rhetoric. Another text, as a 35-year-old male, I still occasionally get fed misogynistic content on social media and other short-form video websites. I know I have to quickly scroll off it. If you dwell on the content, the companies will feed you more. These companies are shamelessly feeding young men destructive content to hold their attention and to profit off it. Well, this is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, life on the road with rock and roll bands seems pretty glamorous, but what does a roadie's retirement look like? And what can other industries learn from the original gig workers? The 70s, 80s and 90s were the decades that built Australian rock. Were you there? Were you in the audience in those decades celebrating live music in all its sweaty, sticky carpeted glory? You probably remember the names of the famous musicians you saw on stage, but I doubt you ever knew the names of the people in the background who made it happen. The roadies, who started early, worked late, partied hard and spent life on the road for months at a stretch. They were the backbone of Australia's rock and roll scene, but now it's taking a toll physically, emotionally, and socially. And roadies aren't the only ones in insecure gig work. It's becoming more common. So what happens when this career comes to an end? What does retirement look like after life on the road? Well, Adelaide University researchers are working with former roadies to understand the particular challenges they face as they age and what other industries can learn from this. You're about to hear all about it, but I'd love to hear from you too. What toll has your work taken on you? Even if it was a dream job, one that looked glamorous from the outside, one that you loved, maybe it didn't love you back. Tell me about the toll your work's taken on you, how that has looked in your retirement. 0418-226-576. Here with me to chat about the study is Associate Professor Brad West, Co-Director of the Social Relationships and Communities Research Group at Adelaide University, and Rod Louis Gung, former roadie, now in his 70s, a director of the Australian Road Crew Association, which is a not-for-profit that supports former roadies. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Rod, I might start with you. Tell me how you became a roadie.
That's an interesting story. After a family tragedy when I was very young, a school friend rang me up and said, Rod, we need somebody to carry some boxes and set up PAs. And I stupidly, maybe, certainly naively said, oh, yeah, I can do that. And so I left home at 18 and joined a rock and roll band. And that was it. Basically going from knowing absolutely nothing to a 50-year career in the music and associated industries.
That's wild. Can you carry a box 50 years later? You're an expert.
No, I can't. The body's broken down.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I do want to talk about that. I'm also keen to know, like, who'd you work with? Anyone that I'd recognise?
Look, I started at the time when a lot of the people that are famous now were just starting out, and they wouldn't remember me from a bar of soap. However, I had Nick Cave rehearsing in my bedroom at one stage. I did one of Midnight Oil's gigs at a hotel in downtown Prahran in Victoria when they were just a struggling band. And it's been that way for most of my career. I haven't had to do the really, really hard yards of a lot of my brethren or my contemporaries. So I've been very lucky, but that's one of the reasons why I can actually see myself giving something back now.
Sure. So you didn't do big stints on the road, but it's a pretty common part of that industry. What's like a day in the life of a roadie typically?
Oh, get up and have breakfast at 6 a.m., jump in the truck, drive to the town, wherever it is. It could be 300 kilometres, 500 kilometres away, set the gig up, go and have some dinner, go back to the gig, work through the gig, making sure that everything is working properly. Then at the end of it, when the musicians have left the stage, it's up to you to pack it up, put it back in the truck, and then you're off to the next town or you're off for a sleep, and then it's a constant grind. Now, when I was doing it, I did it as a solo operator. So it was me doing all of that at setting it up, operating it, breaking it down, and then moving on. But it gets to be something that is all-consuming.
You said you ended up working pretty much 50 years in the industry. Do most people see it as a long-term career when they get in?
Probably not. I know I certainly did. Didn't. Yeah. I had no idea what I was getting myself in for, and it just so happens that I was able to pivot to other areas of the industry, which increased my longevity in it.
So, Brad, you're listening to Rod, you're doing this study. What do we know at this stage about the kind of work this can take, the kind of toll this work can take physically and mentally?
Yes, it's complicated, partly because, you know, these jobs are precarious. They take a toll on the body, but they're also one which you sort of indicated that the people often love it as well. You know, they have a real strong attachment to the industry. It becomes a lifestyle. And unlike some other jobs, you know, when you love it, you know, it's even harder to leave it. You know, the toll afterwards, you know, it's a... You know, all that sort of emotional, physical intensity, you know, in its own way is enjoyable, but makes it, you know, people more isolated when they leave, because as they get older, you know, they haven't established those sorts of connections. They haven't, you know, embedded themselves in communities or, you know, mainstream society, if you like, the ways that others have that help them, you know, age well.
What can that mean in retirement or in later life?
Look, I mean, it can mean both, you know, significant economic insecurity and, you know, the Australian Road Crew Association, you know, is really established to help its members and those who they know who are doing it hard. There's plenty of examples of that. But there's also a sense of social isolation or a sense of just kind of being forgotten. And, you know, as you mentioned, that, you know, we know about the music history from the artist's perspective, but we often don't know it from, you know, those backstage workers. And so part of what we're trying to help the Australian Road Crew Association out is, you know, to better understand the difficulties and challenges that its members and others are facing, but also to raise awareness of, you know, what their contribution has been to the Australian live music industry, but also how we can improve their well-being, particularly through peer support, something that, you know, they noticed was doing a lot of good in the annual reunions they'd been organising for over a decade.
So we're talking about roadies. That's obviously a really specific niche, but do you see implications for other industries, Brad?
Yes, well, it's, I mean, you know, in a way you said they're the original gig workers, but there's plenty of, you know, insecure work now, you know, those who are on contracts, those who, you know, are forced to volunteer before and do internships before, you know, hopefully landing jobs, low wages, long hours, excessive travel, you know, the digital revolution, you know, has you know, only contributed to that, and how that sets people up, you know, later in life. You know, there's lessons to be learned from road crew, and including for, you know, the contemporary road crew itself. So, you know, there's many differences in the scene now in terms of working conditions from that in the 1970s, 1980s, even the 1990s. But, you know, the demand for the services of the Music Industry Charity Support Act, which provides crisis relief and mental health and wellbeing support to music industry crew, you know, there's high demand for that. So, you know, this precarious work is likely to mean that, you know, this new generation will continue to challenge, you know, as they age.
Mm. You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Brad West from Adelaide University and Rod Louis-Gung, former roadie and director of the Australian Road Crew Association, talking about retirement for roadies, but also maybe for other gig workers and how perhaps they are in a place where it's a little bit more precarious, especially socially. And I wonder if this has shown up for you in your work, if your work has taken a toll in a particular way. Greg says, I've been in the electrical trade since 1975, had a rotator cuff shoulder repair 10 years ago, and the other side 2 months ago. Too much crawling in confined spaces. Retiring soon, but no water skiing or snowboarding for me. And Adam says, my uncle's long-term roadie passed away and left my uncle $80,000 in his will. Well, there you go. Well, to talk about maybe making healthy transitions into retirement, protecting your mental health, Professor Nancy Bahana is a geropsychologist and the director of the Healthy Aging Initiative at the University of Queensland. Nancy, welcome back to Life Matters.
Thanks for having me.
So listening to Rod's story and this research project, what are the mental health risk factors in this kind of career?
I think that there's several. I mean, one is that it's such a wonderful, all-encompassing career that a lot of identity gets invested in that. And then if you're faced with then losing that identity, either through I don't have this work or I don't have this social support network, this can really lead to mental distress down the track. And the second thing is that it's often demanding work that has set people apart, maybe from their family. They've had to move around a lot, right? So some traditional sources of support that others might have is lacking.
Are there other types of workplaces that have similar risk factors?
Sure. I can think of lots of different careers in the arts, in long-haul trucking, people who do wildlife caring. You know, there's a lot of careers where people are all in, basically, right? And they're in a community of people. Maybe that's the only community of people that they feel can really understand what they're doing. And they're not usually, they may have a super, they may not have super, they may have not gotten the correct super. And, you know, when it comes to then healthy aging, one of the key supports for healthy aging is social support and also obviously financial security.
So more people are freelancing, more people are doing gig work. The sorts of characteristics of these, that roadie life is maybe a bit more democratic than it was a little while ago. This transition to retirement, how can people prepare for it in a way that sets them up for success?
So this is a huge part of my research. And I think one thing people have to do is recognize that retirement may be in their future, and it may come sooner, like your caller with the rotator cuff injury, you know, may come sooner than you expect. And you can set yourself up for success in a couple of ways. I'm really impressed by the Australian Road Crew Association, their peer support network. I think that such a network, finding people that can carry you through this important transition, is key. And I also like their support network because I think it's intergenerational. People can tell you they've been there and maybe you're just contemplating retirement. And that's a really important thing, to have voices of experience there with you. I'd also like to say that, you know, probably doing some things for health, you know, eating right, that sort of thing is also important to set you up well. But I think of all the factors, that social factor is often overlooked, and it's really key.
You're telling me your stories as well of work that doesn't love you back. Dean says, roadie work is hard. I've been a worker on festivals for decades, big Pentec trucks packed after the gig after midnight, boxes over 100 kilos stacked three high in a tight space, three trucks for one stage, many tons, many millions of dollars, a support system for a band ready to play the next gig 800 kilometres away in 24 hours. Dean says what can't be fixed with gaffer and zip ties hasn't been found yet. Well, Rod, tell me about the Australian Road Crew Association. We've mentioned it a couple of times. How are you supporting former roadies?
The association was originally set up in 2013. It was in response to what was seen at the time as mental health issues, which had manifested itself in suicide rates that were some 2 to 3 times the national average. And the peer-to-peer nature of the roadies group was nurtured by the annual get-togethers that have been every year since then, apart from during COVID. And since then, we've been able to drop the suicide rate to virtually zero. So I think that is definitely a win, and it's a testament to the earlier managing members of the Road Crew Association that they are able to do that. The association gets funds to supply also crisis care and crisis support to its members. Say somebody comes up and says, I can't afford the registration for my car, or my washing machine has broke down, or I don't actually have a place to live right now. We have been working very successfully previously with Support Act, and that will continue. So we, through another subsidiary of our business called Black Box Records, earn funds or get funds from the sale of streaming rights to music, which has been approved by bands, and there's some famous bands there. And we get the streaming rights from Spotify and Tidal and so on. And that money is then passed through to Support Act, and also supplies or enables Support Act to supply additional crisis care to the roadie cohort.
Fantastic work. Rod, Brad and Nancy, thank you all so much for chatting with me today. Rod Louis-Gung, former roadie, director of the Australian Road Crew Association, talking about the really important support work that they do for former roadies. Associate Professor Brad West is the co-director of the Social Relationships and Community Research Group at Adelaide University, which is looking into what roadies need in terms of support after work. And it's relevant to maybe more of you than we thought originally. Thanks, Professor Nancy Bahana, geropsychologist and Director of Healthy Aging Initiative at the University of Queensland, for providing that general advice on preparing for retirement if you haven't had a typical career. Thank you for your texts too. One says, my second position as a speed typist in the Magistrates Court working on tapes, which I thoroughly enjoyed and excelled at, but it left me with ankylosis spondylitis in my neck and low back because no one pulled me up for not supporting my back. Sitting on the front of the office chair, feet crossed underneath, typing at speed. No electric typewriters then. Apparently doing this for 2 years was equal to a carpenter driving nails in with a hammer constantly. Hard work. Well, it's Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up soon, how to talk to a friend who's always down on themselves. But first, Bridget Jones's Diary, 10 Things I Hate About You, She's the Man. Coming up next, Annabelle Crabb explains which Shakespeare adaptation inspired a lifelong passion for the art of writing. Well, Children's Book Week is upon us, the magical time of year where parents across the land are up late pulling together last-minute costumes fashioned after their children's favourite characters from the page. And it's got me thinking about the children's books that stay with you long after you've outgrown them, the ones you revisit with your own kids decades later. And for Annabelle Crabb, there is one book that stayed with her since the first time she read it, nestled among the haystacks on the family sheep farm.
I'm Annabelle Crabb, and the children's book that changed my life is a collection of Shakespeare's stories rewritten for children by, I think, a brother and sister team called Charles and Mary Lamb, and they were known as the Lamb's Tales. So I grew up on a sheep farm on the Adelaide Plains, and my mum and my granny were both big readers. And so I had lots of books that were kind of old books. I picked up the Lamb's Tales, and essentially they just tell the story of, you know, the Merchant of Venice or, you know, the Twelfth Night or whatever. And there were pictures. But the good thing about it, as I've got older, is anytime I go and see a Shakespeare play, I already know the story. So I don't have that kind of, who's this guy situation. So it's actually turned out to be quite a useful little old book to read. I bought a copy of the book for my kids, and I've sort of modernised this idea of exposing kids to Shakespeare by just making sure that they watch some of the great modern movies that are based on Shakespeare plays, like 10 Things I Hate About You, which is, I think, one of the great teen movies of all time. I love that way that Shakespeare kind of reverberates down the generations. And I think that, yeah, I do think that that book has absolutely influenced my life. And I think it's influenced my kids' lives as well, even though they weren't sort of sitting in a haystack reading it the way that I was. But I think it probably inspired a whole lot of different ways of getting into Shakespeare. Sort of say what the life lesson that you draw from Shakespeare is? I mean, as I got older and I started reading the actual plays, which I felt more comfortable about doing because I knew the shape of the story. And I think a lot of people find Shakespeare's language really forbidding, or they find it's hard to get into what the story is. So I think that what that book did for me was to give me the shapes of the stories and make me interested in the stories, which then it's like being in the shallows and then you wade deeper into the language of Shakespeare, which is actually the lesson, you know, the great lesson that I suppose that book brought me towards was the miraculous thing about Shakespeare, which is his experimentation with language, his exuberance with language, the permission he gives himself to make words up, to rhyme, to feel the rhythm of a sentence and to really enjoy it. And I think in my mind, when I write something that I'm happy with, you know, a sentence that feels right, or a word that you slightly make up, but you know that it's the right word. They are the lessons from Shakespeare, I think, is just that permission to play around with language and also to hear the rhythm of language and to take a joy in it. I'm Annabelle Crabb, and that was the children's book that changed my life.
Annabelle Crabb on the children's book that changed her life. Don't forget, voting opens next week in the Top 100 Australian Books Countdown. Keep an eye on the Radio National homepage for that. This is Life Matters. Coming up next, dealing with a friend who's always insulting themselves. If you had to write down everything that made you smile about a loved one, you'd go on for pages. And if someone said a bad word about them, they wouldn't be getting away with it. But what if the person you love is constantly complaining and putting down themselves? We all have periods where negativity can get on top of us, but in the extreme, it can get out of hand. And I read something recently about how this cycle of self-doubt and negativity really impacted a friendship. It got me thinking about the fact that we want to be there for our friends and family, but if someone is constantly, compulsively talking themselves down, what do you do? How do you help a friend break this cycle before it ruins the friendship? Well, I'm about to get into it with our resident psychologist, but I'd love to hear from you if you've had a similar experience with a friend who's constantly putting themselves down. How did it impact your relationship? And were you able to have a constructive conversation about it? With me is Christine Bagley-Jones, our resident psychologist. She joins me fortnightly for Head and Heart. Christine, it is great and not at all negative to see you.
It's lovely seeing you too, Tegan.
What is going on for someone when they are talking themselves down?
Well, it's more common than you may think. A lot of people have those periods of self-doubt and they will go to their friend and have a little bit of a rant about feeling, you know, really down on themselves because of maybe something specific. But if you're seeing a particular friendship mainly themed around that negative self-talk, then it's something bigger than just a phase that someone might be going through.
I do wonder sometimes if it's a bit of a bonding exercise. I can only speak to my own experience. It feels like it happens a lot with women. They're like, oh, I'm so this, I'm so that. And it's sort of meant to be a back and forth where you say something you hate about yourself and I say something I hate about myself and we're somehow bonding over it. Is there ever anything healthy in that?
Yeah, practically never. that self-deprecating, you're right, it is cultural and women tend to do it, but, you know, so do guys as well. There's no health in it. And if you feel bad about something that you might be doing or some trait you have and you want to share it with a friend, that's fine, but you want to do it in the spirit of wanting to get information to maybe shift that way of thinking or the behaviour that's leading to that thinking rather than just being in that cycle of offloading all of your negative self-belief and wanting to be in some way validated or soothed by that friend.
The other thing, the other dynamic that can happen in friendships is someone complains about something and your job is to agree. But if the thing they're complaining about is themselves, it kind of puts you in a tricky position.
Yes. And in fact, they don't want you to agree. They want you to have a counter argument and placate you. And really, that can create a really vicious cycle, because then they will rely on you for that little dance where they tell you how crap they are and you reassure them they're not. And then they feel temporarily soothed, but they haven't got to the source of the problem. So it just becomes that knee-jerk reaction. Oh, I want to talk to Tegan again so she'll tell me I'm great because I feel really bad right now. And that's not actually a solution long term.
Babe, you're so beautiful. I'm actually pretty good at telling people that they're great, because generally they are. I do think, though, it comes with a bit of emotional, it takes something from you to be that person, to be propping someone up all the time. And if that's the dynamic your relationship gets into, it can be quite draining if you're the person that's like, no, babe, you're gorgeous, don't.
Exactly. And you've got to think about how precious the friendship is. And your job is to try to keep the friendship safe if they're not able to. So that self-awareness is key. If you're starting to feel icky and not looking forward to your catch-ups, or thinking, oh, here we go, she's going on that dumping, you know, little rant where she just talks about how terrible she is, and I'm folding into my role here, and I'm finding it really draining, it's not uplifting. And there's this other thing that happens, which is called self-fulfilling prophecy. The more your friend is saying negative things about themselves and you're absorbing it, then you're being conditioned as well. And over time, maybe you're thinking, well, yeah, you're not as great as I thought, but you know, that's not true. So that self-awareness, as soon as you realize it's feeling taxing, use that to harness some change and actually share with them, saying, you know what, I've got to stop you here. You always go down this path and you know how I feel and I really cherish you. Why would I be your friend if this was true? What can we do that actually shifts us away from this so you can start to feel better because I care?
This is it. How do you have that conversation? If someone's already feeling negatively about themselves, they're not just milking it, they're really feeling that way. Maybe receiving more criticism is going to hurt.
Yes. And often these people are highly sensitive, so they're really going to, it's going to really hit them hard. And also, if you're not couching it in the right way, it won't be constructive. They'll just double down on that and they'll think, oh, I can't even turn to Tegan, someone who I have got, like, she's been my sanctuary and now I don't have that. I really am worthless. So be thoughtful how you're going to conduct it and make sure you are very compassionate and you say, I know you don't want to feel this way and you know I don't agree with you, but we have to change this up because this stance isn't good and it's not helping you be the happiest you can be. And then maybe start to think curiously, say, what else can we do? Do you want me to flip it? And every time you say something negative, I'll give you maybe a counter argument, or maybe we don't engage in it at all and we just do something fun.
What if you're the person, you're listening to this and you go, oh no, I'm the negative person. What do I do?
Be kind to yourself. You didn't want to necessarily show up repeatedly in a friendship where you're the negative Nelly and always putting yourself down. You've been conditioned somehow, somewhere in your past. And your job, once you're aware of it, is to figure out how to heal and develop that sense of self-worth and parent yourself a little bit and do the work so that you can show up in a friendship and ensure that it's more reciprocal and that both parties are getting needs met and you're not walking away thinking, oh my goodness, I just did it again. I just dumped again, got my cup filled with their accolades, but I haven't done any of the heavy lifting to A, feel better myself and also be there for them.
On the text line 0418-226-576, one person says, I rarely put myself down except regarding my weight, as I feel embarrassed that I struggle to lose weight. However, a kind, close friend recently pointed out that to me and asked me not to continue it, and I've stopped. The result is not only better for me, but for others, especially women around me.
Yes, because when you put yourself down, you inadvertently put a bit of a spotlight on whatever that topic is, and it can lead to someone thinking, well, gosh, if she's thinking about her weight, should I be thinking about my weight? It creates judgment that doesn't have to exist, and we should always start with ourselves. Like, am I treating myself nicely? If I'm thinking negatively, I need to be rigorous in shifting that so I can delight in my friendships and the company that we engage in. So I think it was a very good friend that highlighted, hey, you don't need to keep referencing your weight. If you're unhappy with it, you explore that yourself or encourage me to be a participant, but I don't want to be a party to you just putting yourself down.
Well, Christine, a delight as always to speak with you.
Lovely to see you.
Christine Bagley-Jones is our resident psychologist. She joins me fortnightly for Head and Heart. And thank you so much for your texts today talking about roadie life, retiring after a life on the road and different jobs that can take a similar toll. Pauline says, I've worked in retail all my adult life, lifting milk crates and chicken crates. This has implanted in my life as I have many bulging discs. Another major problem is many unpaid hours of overtime, especially in management. And that is just about it for Life Matters. I've come to you today from Jagera and Turrbal land. I'll be back with you again tomorrow. We're going to talk about aunties and uncles. Being an excellent adult who's not a parent in the lives of the kids you love, what it's like to see these little kin of yours grow up, watch your siblings grow into themselves as parents too, enjoying this relationship without necessarily wanting to be a parent yourself. Tell me about your nieces and nephews. What do they mean to you? What do you hope you mean to them? I'll be taking your calls after 9 a.m. tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.